Good afternoon, ladies and gentlemen, and thank you for joining us for the Kopernik Global Investors. On today's call, we have David Ivan, Founder, Chief Investment Officer, and Lead Portfolio Manager, to discuss Kopernik's views on the current market environment and the portfolio positioning of its global all-cap strategy. Please note this call is being recorded, and the topics on this call are for informational purposes only and should not be regarded as a recommendation or an offer to buy or sell any product or service to which this information may relate. Certain products or services may not be available to all entities or persons. Please consider all risks carefully before investing. All participants will initially be in a listen-only mode. Following Mr. Ivan's discussion, there will be an opportunity to ask questions. To ask a question, please press star one on your touch-tone phone. At this time, I'd like to turn the conference over to Nick Roberts.
Thank you, Paula. Good afternoon, and on behalf of our entire firm of Kopernik Global Investors, we thank you for joining the quarterly conference call and also for your continued support. Kopernik recently celebrated its two-year anniversary on July 1st, 2015, and we are humbled and very appreciative of your continued advocacy, especially in these difficult times. Our investment process and current portfolio reflect the commitment to our conviction that owning very good companies, including leaders in their respective industries, currently trading at or near all-time low valuations and prices, will ultimately result in adding significant alpha to your clients' portfolios. By almost any metric, this is the cheapest portfolio Dave has ever managed. Before I pass the call over to Dave Ivan, I'd like to provide you with a quick firm update. At the close of the second quarter of 2015, our firm is currently managing roughly $1.9 billion in assets under management, up from roughly $1.5 billion at the end of the first quarter of 2015. The feedback we get from many clients is that our lack of correlation to both other active managers as well as passive strategies makes us a compelling option right now in an uncertain market environment. During today's call, Dave will be referencing a presentation whose link was sent to you in the invitation, but also can be accessed through our website, kopernikglobal.com. And I know there's sometimes some questions about the spelling of our name, so I'm going to give it to you quickly. It's just K-O-P-E-R-N-I-K-G-L-O-B-A-L.com, kopernikglobal.com. Again, thank you for joining us, and I will now pass the call over to Dave Ivan, our founder, CIO, and lead portfolio manager. Thanks, Dave.
Okay, thanks, Nick, and thanks to everybody for joining us. Once again, it's a very interesting time in the market. I think the perfect time to be having this discussion. We can start with page six. And for those who believe the market's efficient, it's really difficult to explain times right now. For those of us who believe the market's inefficient, you have to get pretty excited times like now, because we think the inefficiency is at a pretty extreme level. And page six, just a cartoon, but really what the market's doing right now is paying a big premium for certainty. We think this is risky because we think they're paying for something that does not exist. Sooner or later, they're going to have to deal with the fact that life is uncertain. So if we go to page seven, in review, those of you that have been with us for a while, you heard me last year talk about how much it reminded me of 1999. This year sure seems to be looking a lot like 2000. As Mark Twain says, history doesn't repeat, but it rhymes. Yeah, this is important, and if I can pause and step back a minute, this market right now is the reason we decided to create Kopernik in the first place. And this is a market that, as painful as it is a market that's very extended, quite bifurcated, highly correlated, irrational. Yeah, this is important because when things become highly correlated in their irrationality, it's an important time to differentiate oneself. And we like having somehow become an option that looks, I guess for a better word, like we're the antidote to correlation. In 1999-2000, it was extremely painful for me and for most other value managers that I knew, but it was by far the most rewarding time in my career that's a third of a century now. Yeah, the subsequent 12 years were a lot of fun, but they were nowhere near as rewarding as that time. As, well, what seemed like pain at the time was really an incredible opportunity to make a lot of money, and make a lot of money by taking advantage of a market that priced things as a result of people's belief that Mr. Greenspan could control everything, and their belief that the Internet somehow had repealed the laws of economics and of mathematics. We all know how that ended. The current environment, pretty amazing, too, that people seem to believe that Mario Draghi and Janet Yellen and the Bank of Japan and others right now are, you know, omnipotent. They can create wealth out of thin air. We think we know how that'll end. They also, like 99, confuse an exciting story with a good investment. We believe the fact that people have gotten pretty good at mapping genomes does not make things a good price at seven times the level they were at a few years ago. So, yeah, to sum it all up, this is pretty exciting time. It's painful that feels if it's the right place, the right time, as the song goes. No place we'd rather be. Where are we? We are in a market that's bifurcated. This is back to our first day at Copernic. You can see emerging markets have done nothing. And the world markets have done very little. Pretty much to perform, you had to be in the U.S., the very market people hated 4 or 5 years back. That was the place to be. It's gotten pretty extended. Yeah, it's become a momentum market. Yeah, how does that happen? If we go to page 9, I think people misperceive risk. We've talked a lot about that, whether things like volatility and correlation or tracking error and things like that. Certainly, they offer a career risk, but not risk to the portfolio. As a matter of fact, when things come expensive, you don't want to be correlated. It is interesting if people talk about, say, shark attacks. People say, oh, it is risky to go in the water. When someone gets attacked by a shark, it makes all the headlines. It does not make the headlines when somebody has a heart attack on the beach. And so we go there and eat our Fritos and say, I'm not going in the water. But according to this chart, 1 in 5 chance of a heart attack in a lifetime, 1 in 3.7 million. People worry about the wrong risk. Talking to a colleague of mine outside of work who does athletic stuff, working with athletes and stuff, talking about how much stress a cycle can take and whether humans are designed to take risk or run by risk. And they're saying, isn't it interesting that roller coasters are something people pay for, but, you know, they're kind of risky. But, nah, it's not risky. That's the point. It is thrilling to ride a roller coaster, but it is not risky. People do not pay money to go out onto a battlefield. They will pay money to skydive, but they won't pay money to jump from a plane with no parachute. It is interesting how people behave there versus in the investment market. And we've talked in the past how if people go to a store and they find the suit they wanted was marked down in price, they get excited and buy it. But if they go to the stock market and find a stock that was 12 yesterday and is 8 today, they don't view that as a markdown. They view that as risky. They have it backwards. It is interesting how people will not put money in volatile stocks. They don't pay for the roller coaster in the stock market. They fear the roller coaster. But just as if the heart attack is the real risk for those of us going to the beach, buying bonds at 3% for 30 years, yeah, as we've talked about that in the past, that's beyond risk. If your needs are to make 5, 6, 7, 8% a year and you lock your money at 3%, that's beyond risk. Why is it that people will not buy a stock that's yielding 10, 20, 30% on average, but it's volatile, and yet they'll lock their money up long-term at rates of return that are pretty well guaranteeing failure? That's interesting, though. Not only do they have the risk wrong, it compounds itself, because if you want low volatility, Wall Street and the Feds and others find a way to give you the appearance of low volatility. But what's the saying? Stability in and of itself is destabilizing. And I think having taken short-term volatility out of the market, the Federal Reserve has caused a lot of malinvestment, I think we can find that the future will probably offer more volatility. But as we go to page 12, it's interesting how 4 or 5 years ago the dollar was considered risky. Now the dollar is considered the safe place to be, the place you have to be. A question that comes up all the time is, why don't we have everything in the dollar? Just like 4 or 5 years ago, people would say, why don't we get everything out of the dollar? Why own the dollar? The saying I hear over and over and over again is, the dollar is the cleanest dirty shirt. Rather than have an opinion on whether it's the cleanest dirty shirt, I've got a matrix here of a bunch of pretty soiled garments. And which is best and which isn't, I don't know. I'll leave that up to you. I'm not going to say the dollar is better. I'm not going to say that the dollar is worse. I will say that, looking at this, a prudent investor should not have all their money in any one of these currencies. I think diversifying beyond the dollar is a very important thing to do. Further on the same subject, leverage, I think, is understood. You'll increase risk. Here we have something showing the absolute level of leverage and the increase in leverage, thereby growing today at the expense of tomorrow. I think everybody understands Greece and Ireland and Portugal and Japan have their challenges, Spain and France too. It's interesting how Argentina, Russia, and Brazil, the really risky ones, at least by this one measure, are the least risky ones. Returning to the U.S., it is a wonderful thing to have high margins, to have the highest ever, and double normal is a wonderful thing. However, if people are pricing in those margins to last into the future, then a good thing becomes quite risky, because history, logic, theory, everything would suggest that margins do not stay above normal forever, especially in a zero interest rate environment. The cost of capital is zero. At school, they taught us the return on capital eventually approaches that cost of capital. The direction will be down. Another risk is financial engineering. Everybody's looking for the U.S. to keep growing, but this chart here is interesting because the amount of money going to dividends and buybacks from various studies I've seen, pretty much it's 100%. No money's being reinvested in growth. If you're a company, growing your business is really hard. Buying your stock back to manipulate up EPS at the expense of real wealth, that's an easy way. You make your book value drop, your return on book goes up. But at any rate, the more money that goes into stock buybacks and dividends is at the expense of future growth. And, yeah, it would be great if the market was efficient and people, you know, decided that buying low and selling high was a good thing to do. But people running companies, they have a long history of doing the opposite. They buy when the cash flow is high, which tends to be the top, and they panic at the bottom and sell. This just shows recent history of the last 15 years. You can see that late 07, early 08 was just unparalleled amount of buybacks. They bought at the top. We all know what followed. We now have surpassed that level. I think, one, people should be a suspect on their earnings estimates they're seeing. Two, wonder about stock prices. They're going up based on borrowing and buying at all-time highs versus economic growth. So a lot of things going on, a lot of psychology. That's good. As Warren Buffett says, in the short term, a voting machine. In the long run, a weighing machine. So with that, let's try to weigh a few things. Time is an interesting thing. If you look at the last couple of years, just like 98, 99, the last couple of years have been pretty painful for value people. You buy things that are way too cheap just to watch them drop. And 2 years seems like an incredibly long time. But really, it's not. Maybe I'm getting older, but it's not. And so let's put things into perspective if we can. Gold mines, and almost all gold mines now, they're going to take 10 years or more to bring on the stream. But let's take a well-known one. Pascua Lama is something that Barrick found 25 years ago. They have spent $6 billion on it. They plan to spend $8.5 billion by the time it's done. It's difficult building mines. All kinds of things can lead to cost overruns. You have to find it, and you have to drill it out, and you have to get feasibility studies and pre-feasibility studies and financing, deal with governments. You need to worry about the risks of geology and geography and chemistry and engineering and cost overruns and things turning out different than you thought. Then you have to worry about changes in regulatory and compliance and environmental and legal businesses. It's a difficult thing. So they spend 25 years on it. The market has just knocked down Barrick stock by 85% from the top. We bought in too early, but we're buying billions of dollars of investment and decades of time and quality for assets that are scarce and cannot be replaced. I would rather be a year or two or three too early than too late to buy that kind of work, that kind of effort, that kind of irreplaceability, to miss out on that. The upside is tremendous. That's gold. Uranium, maybe even more so. Next month I'm going to go visit this mine that just got finished, that Cameco has been working on for 35 years. Pretty amazing thing. $2.6 billion. There again, to control the water, to go way deep in the ground and freeze things to make them mineable, all the technology and the engineering. It is just unbelievable what it takes to bring on a mine. 35 years worth of effort. The stock's been marked down. We'll come back to that. Once again, when things are trading at 10 or 20 cents on the dollar and it takes that kind of effort, once again, I'd rather be a couple of years too early than miss this incredible opportunity. Last year, talking nonstop about, or a half year ago, Russia, and a year ago is all China, and various times gold. The topic lately is coal. It's really phenomenal how stocks can drop 5% every single day. I guess the idea is that we're not going to use coal anymore. Coal is pretty complicated. But coal is abundant. It's cheap. It's still over half the world's electricity. Might be wonderful it was going away. It is not going away. After being a growth business my entire lifetime, it is no longer a growth business. But being priced as if it's going away, that's a mistake. But within that, we have Peabody. There are various coal companies that are really in trouble. There's a few of them that have gone bankrupt. There's more that are going to go bankrupt. People are pricing Peabody for bankruptcy. We think they've missed it. We think they've missed things like unprofitable hedges rolling off in the near future and CapEx going lower than it was a few years back and payments for the properties dropping. For a lot of reasons, the costs are going to be more manageable. And coal cyclical, prices are going to come back. But for this analysis, we're assuming they don't. Let's say things stay bad. The losses are far less than the billion and a half of capital that is available to the company. So there's some risk here. The market sees way more risk than there probably is. If we're going to take risk, there certainly needs to be potential return. Couple points here. People have heard us talk about in the past that we can lose money on 3 out of 10 stocks and make money on 7 out of 10, and on a portfolio basis still make a lot of money. So our goal is not to never be wrong, and we're going to, like I say, be wrong on 30% of our stocks, and that's life. If we're wrong on Peabody, that's fine, because so many of our other stocks have 5 or 10 times upside. But at the last slide, we don't think we're wrong on Peabody. We think the number one independent coal company in the world is diversified, that has properties in different continents, and they have different types of coal, a huge range of coal, and they have a manageable balance sheet. They'll be okay. And if we're right, they're going to be okay. There's all kinds of ways to value it, but if you take the coal that's already developed near infrastructure and you say, oh, the rest of those resources are worth nothing, the stock's worth $6.50 versus something that's trading at less than $1.50 right now, pretty amazing. Oh, and by the way, they do own a lot of other stuff that can be developed. If you value fairly conservative values for the coal they own, and this still isn't all the coal, but most of their reserves, the stock could be worth $61. Not a prediction, just what could be. So if we're wrong, we lose $1.40. If we're right, make many, many, many times our money. That's the kind of risk-reward we like, especially when we're buying a premier company and a business that is not going away. I could go on a long time on this, but let me just go on a little bit on this. It is said that all of us portfolio managers have ADD. That's maybe to some extent true. Yeah, we all want something to happen now, so we don't have the patience to wait 2 or 3 years for something to work out. We really ought to. People like Warren Buffett and Howard Marsh and others do have that kind of patience, and the results have shown. Right now, it's the extreme. Rather than wait 3 years or even 3 minutes, people can conjure up billions of dollars in a microsecond. The last 6 or 7 years, they've conjured $4 trillion out of thin air. Ben Bernanke had told us, it costs nothing or virtually nothing to do that. So here's something that takes seconds to produce, or fractions of a second to produce, and cost nothing, and have grown like crazy. They yield nothing. They are not scarce. The Federal Reserve has told us it's their intention to make them continue to lose purchasing power. And yet investors hold it into really high esteem, while simultaneously holding in low esteem gold mines, like I told you. The Barrick is off 85% from the top. They hold in low esteem uranium mines. We've talked in the past how uranium's a growth business now, and they're going to be building 60-some-odd new reactors. They need to get the uranium from somewhere. Cameco is finished a mine, as I said, took 30 years to build. The stock is now 75% off sale. Dams, hydroelectric dams are a fascinating thing. I might have mentioned the past this book, Colossus. It's a fascinating read about the Hoover Dam and the decades it took to get that thing up and going, and the feuds between the states and the regulatory problems, the hassles and the engineering nightmares and the deaths and you name it. And you know, read about Three Gorges and Aswan and all that. It's an amazingly hard thing to do. We find that two of the best hydro properties in the world, Rest Hydro, off 83%, straight into a third of book value. Electrobras in Brazil, 93% off sale, 14% of book value. This took decades to come up with this brand. It's cheap, it's clean, it's an amazing competitive advantage, way below replacement value. If we're a year or two early buying these things, so be it. We've gone telecoms pretty successfully, one country after another, depending upon where they're given away over the last few decades. I think a year ago we talked about the Chinese one that was the biggest and was trading 8 times earnings. We sold it when it ran up to 14 times earnings. Korea Telecom, like all telecom in 1999, was very, very expensive, and that now is on an 83% off sale also, 2/3 of book value. The earned yield is 10%. It's a duopoly. It'll be very, very hard to replace. Nuclear power, like I say, not going away. The biggest nuclear fleet is in France. That's only 81% off instead of 83% off. That's a fraction of replacement cost. Also, Japanese trading companies, 70% a book, also 10% earned yield. I mean, people like bonds at 2%. 10% earned yield, that would be very hard to come up with. Trading franchises and property ownerships and the sort of thing these companies own. We've talked in the past about farmland. There's a book called Collapse, rather depressing book, but informative book. A lot of chapters on different things, but one is on farmland, having really good quality topsoil that's not eroding, that's close to water, that's close to infrastructure, that can be utilized, a rare thing. To be buying farmland that earns yields of 10, 20, 30, 40%, fascinating thing. Granted, they happen to be in Brazil and Indonesia and Ukraine and places like that, but good quality, well-managed properties. Tankers, it's a lot of work to build a tanker, a lot of capital involved. People buy a tanker, the stock market turns around and says, here, you can have it for less than half a price, sometimes 30%. Last year they gave us oil tankers for next to nothing. This year it's bulk tankers for next to nothing. I could go on and on, but let's stop with that. And continuing on, resources in general. People loved them 4 years ago. They hate them now. This shows that relative to financial assets, we are approaching that sort of 1999-2000 peak. Commodities are incredibly cheap relative to financial assets. I don't know if people are familiar with Kirill Sokolov, his 13D research, fascinating piece, and how he comes up with that much insightful stuff week after week. I don't know, but highly recommend it. A couple of weeks ago, he was comparing commodities now to times like 1977 New York City when the Reichmans were in there buying properties for a buck. Time when townhouses in Manhattan sold for $40,000. Why? Because they were negative cash flow in the near term. Things were so depressed that just keeping the maintenance up was an expensive thing. Talks about Donald Brand and Irvine Ranch. And, you know, people hated negative cash flow. Talks about how in the 80s when you had the last commodities collapse, it was people were able to buy things at zero. That shortly thereafter were making $100,000. He's talking about now that the things that were bought 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 years ago in the commodity space by big, well-known companies are just being dumped. 99% losses. Get me out at any price. We have a lot of companies we're familiar with where the near term will be negative cash flows. You have to keep the maintenance up and going. Now's the time to buy great properties. Now's the time to be making 50 times your money. They don't mention in this John Polson's thing, it's interesting, the few books that were written about him and others that were betting against mortgages in 05, 06, 07, negative cash flow in 05, negative cash flow in 06, negative cash flow in 07, home run in 08, 09. It's sometimes people pay a lot for a small positive cash flow, and they avoid great values if they don't see positive cash flow. Now they avoid negative cash flows. This slide here will probably keep showing you. I know you've seen it before, and as I've told you in the past, it inspired by 1999 when I saw a gentleman comparing Intel to India and how could Intel have a larger market cap than the whole country of India. It turned out to be a mistake on the market's part. All these years later, Intel's not up. India's up massively. Apple's a wonderful company. I do not believe that any one company is worth more than two of the biggest economies on Earth and ones with the most natural resources. In general, those two and emerging markets in general. And we've gone a long way from where you must own the bricks. Now you can't own the bricks at any price, unless they're Chinese A shares till a month ago, I guess. But it's interesting. Growth economies, and then there's the U.S. Highest book value on this chart, second highest PE on the chart, highest price to sales on the chart. The U.S. is the most expensive market in the world right now. I don't think the next 10 years will show that it's the fastest growing in the world. That seems highly unlikely. So U.S. and a lot of developed markets, no problem with them. Great countries, good companies, aggressive stock prices. Other places have great resources, great management, cheap prices for monopolies, oligopolies, scarce resources, franchises that took decades to build, things that took decades to build that meet the needs of human beings, I think will in the long run be worth more than pieces of paper that yield zero. And with that, let's take questions.
Thank you. Once again, it is star one on the phone lines to ask a question. Please make sure your mute button is turned off before pressing star one. Once again, star one for questions. And we'll first go to Michael Sheldon with RDM Financial.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. A couple of quick questions. One is, you seem to be generally pretty upbeat about commodities. Obviously, they're out of favor right now, and there probably is a good reason for that. Can you sort of talk about your expectations for what's going on in China? They seem to be switching more from a commodity-based growth cycle to a consumer goods and consumer services cycle. And then also, just had a quick question. In terms of Peabody, you had a couple of pretty good slides on there with a balance sheet and an income statement going out to 2020. Can you just talk about what makes you feel so confident in your estimates, given that other coal companies right now seem to be going out of business left and right? Thank you.
Sure. No, very good questions, and certainly the right things to be discussed right now. We believe there is a price for everything. We also think when people have moderate expectations and we have moderate expectations, and quibbling over a dime here and there is not so helpful. Those of you that have known us a long time, as much as we like commodities and as much as we like agriculture and energy and emerging markets and things, 4 years ago we were out of energy and mostly out of our emerging markets and out of half our gold and out of 100% of our industrial commodities because the market loved them. They loved them too much. To your point, they thought China was going to grow fast forever, insatiable appetite for commodities. China's grown fairly fast. It's just very disappointing to people that were looking for insane growth forever. Now, you're right, China has slowed down. They've got a bubble that's collapsing, it looks like, so probably slow down even more. And in addition to the slowdown, you're right, they're transitioning more to a sustainable model, consumer and whatnot, which is good. The capital intensity of their growth 4 or 5 years ago was off the charts. It was beyond what you saw in Korea and Taiwan and Japan and other places. It was something that could not be sustained. So there is no optimism priced into commodities right now. I don't know anybody that's saying, oh, yep, China's going to bounce back strong and start buying a bunch of commodities. I'm not hearing that anywhere. People who were worried 4 or 5 years ago that printing money is inflationary now are yawning at the fact that we did print $4 trillion and that the Japanese and Europeans are racing to see how much they can print, but nobody's pricing in the fact that that might be inflationary. The amount of resources that have been found, there's been really no major discoveries of uranium or gold and not a whole lot of copper. There's been some, so the supply is not there. People are assuming no demand forever. We think there'll be demand someday. When they come, what will the price be? Both logic and history suggest that when things are trading well below the incremental cost of production, you need to get the price above that or there won't be production. So we believe that as demand, you know, we're not even predicting pick up or do well if demand continues. We think you need to see the price of uranium double, and you need to see the price of gold go up $1,000 from here, and you most likely see the price of coal go up from here, and yeah, a lot of things are trading below sustainability levels, and so we think prices go up, and like I said, it is not predicated on trends changing in China. They're doing what they have to do. Unsustainably high growth is slowed down, and unsustainably high capital intensity is transitioning to a better model. So that's all good. You don't need much of anything good to happen for eventually these commodities to pick up in price. And then, of course, we're not even buying the commodities out there in the market. We're buying these commodities at big discounts on Wall Street. And so that's even better. On Peabody, yeah, now things are really bad for coal. The coal industry went nuts. They also fell into the myth that the demand from China 4 years ago was sustainable. They paid a lot of high prices. They all leveraged up at the top. The industry overexpanded. They are paying the price. We are not fully short-term on the industry, and you know, the models I showed were not showing any growth, any improvement. But what ought to happen is the weaker players go under, and that's what's happening. The weaker players are going under. Now the market is starting to say that the fairly strong players are going to go under. We think they're wrong, and we think that the company is a survivor. We also like the math.
Thank you.
And once again, it is star one at this time for questions. Moving on, we'll go to Hal Heselton with Merrill Lynch.
Hey, Dave. Thanks a lot for your time today. My question is, you're still buying companies based on their fundamentals? Because I know you have strong beliefs about the Fed and about the macro situation, but are you still buying your companies based on the fundamentals of each and every company? Is that correct?
That is absolutely correct, which has always been the case and always will, but it is nice to have a backdrop that's probably icing on the cake, if you will, but your point is also, like I mentioned, really cyclical, and fads come in and fads come out. Passive investment, I think, is a cyclical phenomena. So there are times where lots of people do what we do, where a lot of people analyze companies and say, what are the company's fundamentals and what is a good price to pay for this? And when everybody's doing that, it's tougher to add value, to be better than they are at establishing fundamentals and better than they are at valuing it. You know, we think we can do that, but it's tougher. And then there are times like 1999 and now where very few people even bother. People don't care about company fundamentals. They don't care about valuation. They say, what's hot? Let's buy the biotech ETF. Let's buy a U.S. ETF. Let's buy a China ETF. Let's sell the China ETF. You know, and it becomes a casino out there. And, yeah, like I said earlier, that's short-term. That's very frustrating. Long-term, that is a wonderful thing. Passive investing means we don't care about price. We don't care about the fundamentals of the companies. We may or may not know what companies are even in the index. And we're happy when a company gets added to the index to buy it at a new high, and when it gets thrown out to subsequently buy it after it drops. And I understand and don't disagree with the positives of passive investing, but people forget the negatives. And for passive investing to work, few people have to be doing it. You have to be writing the tails of all the investors that are doing the analysis and making the market semi-efficient. But when almost everybody is doing passive investing, then the tail's wagging the dog. The people writing the coattails of the other investors are, there's nobody establishing the fundamentals anymore. There's no anchor to reality. That usually ends better for the active investors than it does for the passive investors. And I think we are at pretty extremes once again between the price of popular stocks versus the price of unpopular stocks.
That's great. Thank you very much.
And as a final reminder, star one at this time for questions. Next, we'll go to Dan Gallagher with UBS.
Yeah, Dave, I understand that that we can be wrong on 3 out of 10 and still get great returns, but in terms of the risk controls, on something like Peabody, when the debt starts trading below 70, and I'm looking on my screen and I'm seeing debt trading at 24, 25, highest at 30 cents on the dollar, it doesn't seem like the fixed income people who do really good work, agree with you and that point of view. And I'm wondering just, just an anchoring, I know I'm right on this, when the bonds are telling you something totally different, do you think of, is it possible? Do you own too much of the common to move into the debt, in case things go splat and you end up with the entity? I mean, are you looking at other alternatives of having Peabody exposure? And how do you make sure that you're not being pigheaded?
Yeah, no, the couple excellent questions all buried into that one. We do look at the debt. I actually have spent a fair amount of my career doing bonds as well as stocks. I've always liked the fact that sometimes the bond market and the stock market do look at things entirely different. Sometimes the bond market is right on and the equity markets are crazy, and other times the bond market gets kind of crazy and equities are more rational. Sometimes they're both rational. Sometimes neither of them are rational. That's one thing we've looked. Should we roll out of the common into the various bonds that are out there? And there's lots of different bonds. The bonds look good now. We like them. The equity, though, if the equity might be worth somewhere between $6 and $60, hard-pressed to want to roll into the bonds, even though the bonds are attractive. That's one point. Another point is, yes, we are looking at other coal companies. We did own Shenhua and made a profit on it. Earlier on, we decided that Arch was pretty equal upside to Peabody, but more risk, and so we rolled out of that. And since then, I think Arch has done a little worse, but it hasn't been spectacularly better. But we are looking at other ones because the industry's been hit. As far as pig-headed, it's an interesting business we're in because you need to be very confident and not blow with the wind and buy high and sell low when things look bad, and at the same time not become pig-headed or arrogant because that's when you blow people up. We try to anchor things into some concept of intrinsic value that becomes helpful. So when things go up or down for cyclical reasons, we stay pinned to the long run, normalized intrinsic value. That's one thing we do that's helpful. Another thing we say, all right, if it's a company-specific thing, maybe we're missing something. Usually when, as I said earlier, when everybody's just saying, buy biotech, sell commodities, all right, well, if Peabody was going down, that's fine. But when you look at all commodity stocks of all kinds just plunging, good balance sheets, bad balance sheets, good supply demand, bad supply demand, people are just getting out. So this doesn't seem to be a Peabody-specific thing. Although, yeah, that they, you know, that gives us some comfort. Another thing, we've done the map, we've shown you that. Another thing, I've always liked that saying that if we're all sitting around playing poker and I look around the table and I can't identify the sucker, then I'm probably the sucker. And so when we're buying and somebody else is selling, have I done a model and he's done a model and my math analysis shows one thing and his is another, and maybe if I say I'm right and he's wrong, then maybe I'm arrogant. If he doesn't even have a model, he doesn't even care. He is selling coal because the Norwegian government ordered him to, or because Obama has been attacking it and it's politically incorrect to own the stuff, or because NGOs are selling him stuff saying, get out. And it's just massive panic and it's going down any time. I don't know, you know, people that are selling this because they don't think it's worth more. They're selling because they need out. They do not want commodities, and they sure as hell don't want coal. And so I like buying when the people on the other side are selling for uneconomic reasons. That I find helpful. A last thing to consider, if we're going to be right 7 times and wrong 3 times, let's not put our whole portfolio in the 3 that are wrong. So we don't put more than 5% in any one name. That would be stocks and bonds put together. We have put as much into Peabody as we're going to. We still think we're going to be right. We are not putting more money into it. If we're wrong, it's contained to what we already have now. That's a discipline we've been using for 30 years, and it works well, too. So that also can keep us from being pig-headed and cause damage. So that's an important question you had. Thank you very much.
No, thank you for that answer. As also, you know, these commodity businesses that they're price takers, and some of them have debt, and you know, there's forces of nature that kind of dictate, you know, how well they do in a short to intermediate run. Can you give me or us, you know, a couple examples of better businesses, you know, that have bigger moats around their business that are expanding, and just kind of ideas that you have that you know, that, you know, a neophyte like me might think is compelling. You know, examples like you have of value that aren't in industries that are as troubled.
Sure. And let's try to answer that several ways. Yeah, if you take healthcare in 1991, it was one of the most overvalued businesses imaginable, and the stocks plunged for years and years. And when Obama was elected, people gave him away. So we were able to buy Eli Lilly for 8 times earnings and Pfizer for 8 times earnings and Aetna, things like that. We're very happy to buy stable businesses like that. And so we definitely have done that kind of thing. We've been very happy to buy, for a lot of years, we had the U.S. railroads. They were cyclical growth, but they were growth. You look at what their earnings and sales have done over the last 15 years, and they had a wide moat around them. You know, we do spend a lot of time on the moats, a lot of time on the moats. As a matter of fact, you know, I think most people know, but really quickly, a lot of value-based investors say we want a margin of safety. You hear numbers like 30%. We say, why 30%? If the moat's really wide, 10% discount's fine. If the moat's less wide, then we want maybe 30 or more. If in addition to the moat not being wide, there's other risks such as geopolitical risk or things like that, we want more. And so Johnson & Johnson and Nestle's and things like that, we'd be happy to buy them at a 10% discount to a conservative estimate of intrinsic value, where the businesses that are more dicey, we want a way bigger moat. But over the years, certainly we've owned the Walmarts of the world, and we've owned beverage companies and food companies and transportation companies, and still own phone companies. Matter of fact, the businesses we have aren't generally stable earnings, but they tend to have wide moats. Yeah, there's a wide moat around if you have a railroad, and we own railroads in Japan and in China, and there's a wide moat if you have a cellular infrastructure such as China last year and Korea right now. And there's wide moats right now. We have, say, SkyWest Airlines, where they have over 50% of the regional airline business. That's not a wide moat, but it's a decent moat. And that's a company that's grown business, grown book value a lot over the last 25 years, although not after over the last few. And also, if you want some of the companies that pretty wide moats and quite profitable that we can actually afford at value prices, just associate Russia with the name, and you can have Sberbank and get one of the most profitable banks on earth year in, year out. Very wide moat, dominant business, Gazprom. How about you own the infrastructure that goes from where the gas is to where the gas is used, whether that's Europe or in the future China? That's an incredibly wide moat and pretty stable, and they just announced that volumes have been the highest on record. So, no, we are happy to do that. But I'll well say in 1972, the Nifty 50 was the wrong time to buy big, stable Coca-Cola and Procter & Gamble and Gillette and all those things. And in 1982, I was buying all that stuff. It was a beautiful thing. They were very cheap. Right now, the market is willing to pay outrageous prices for bonds. And stable, wide moat U.S. businesses are being priced as a derivative of bonds, if you will. People are using low discount rates, and so I love those companies. I think owning those stocks will work out about like it did for people that bought those stocks in 1972. There is a price for everything.
Okay, so in the current portfolio, your best examples of kind of healthy companies with wide moats are, or domiciled in, in Russia?
Yeah, I think the Russian companies, even though they're in a recession right now, tend to be doing very well. But phone companies are pretty healthy, too. So we have the Italian phone company and the Korean phone company. I think the passenger rail companies in China and Japan are healthy, consistently profitable companies. And then we have Japanese trading companies. They're healthy. They make money pretty much year in, year out. They're single-digit PEs. We have Mitsui and Mitsubishi. Those, I think, are healthy. We have a port company in Japan. It's pretty consistently makes money year in, year out. The agriculture companies we have, they've taken hits on their debt, but they are pretty consistently profitable companies, well managed, so volatile but healthy and certainly growing nicely. So now I think we have a lot. We 3-4 months ago bought our first consumer discretionary company in a while, which was Hyundai in Korea. People tend to be knocking everything in Korea down. That's been, over the last 20 years, pretty much a miracle story how well they've done.
Great. Thank you for that.
Next, we'll go to Matyas Bakhter with Battery Global Advisors.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you so much for the call. I'm wondering if there's anything that would, break your gold thesis. Looking around what's been going on in the world the past month or so, it seems like we've seen every possible headline one could hope for in order to push gold prices higher, and they haven't moved. If gold stays at these levels or goes down over the next, 2, 3, 4 quarters or longer, how much room is there for the gold stock positions in the portfolio to really appreciate?
Yeah, it's been fascinating time, isn't it, to watch gold-friendly news come out day after day after day, just to watch the price of gold drop almost every day. It's fascinating. What would break the thesis? If gold is a commodity and the incremental cost is $2,000, it would be tough to break the thesis. I don't think that gold's a commodity. I think gold's money. So right now that's even more bullish because the amount of dollars that have been printed per ounce of gold owned has gone from 400 an ounce in 1980 to 15,000 right now. But to break the thesis, I guess, would take the Fed and the Bank of Japan and the Bank of England and the European Central Bank and everybody to say, we've found religion. we do not believe in QE. We'll never do it again. And not only that, we're going to pull out the $4 trillion that we just put in, and we're going to take interest rates to high rates, and we're going to do like Paul Volcker did. And so instead of people's choices be you can earn 0% on gold, like it's been for 6,000 years and kept its value, and 0% for currencies that are being devalued actively, your choice is now zero on gold and 15% for dollars and euros and things like that. That would break my thesis on gold, although God help people that own stocks and bonds. That's highly, highly unlikely. So I think if we see that happen, yes. But right now, everybody believes that printing money is the answer to every problem, but everybody that has control over such things, I'm not aware of anybody in the world that is saying differently. And so currencies all around the world are being printed. Everybody takes turn printing them. The yields are zero in the short term almost everywhere. There is no financial discipline. And every problem is met with money printing. It would be a major, major change in society to break the thesis for gold, I think. And then keep in mind that gold relative to money is the cheapest it's ever been. Gold relative to cost of production is the cheapest it's ever been. And gold held by mining companies relative to the price of gold out there on the spot market is the cheapest it's ever been. Gold stocks are the cheapest they have ever been relative to gold. So there is a huge, huge margin of safety. If gold goes to 1,000 and stays there for 3 or 4 years, we will not do well. Although I don't know anything if people are looking at toothpaste companies or beer companies or chemical companies or anything, and if people assume the price drops in half from where it was a few years ago and stays there, I don't think there's too many industries that are going to do well. We find that when things get way below their cost of incremental production, have had huge corrections, and the whole industry is suffering, that's usually a bottom. It sure as hell is not a top. And like I was saying, on Peabody, this isn't anywhere near as stressed as that, but the downside is there. The upside is phenomenal. And the industry fundamentals are absolutely compelling, as I suggested.
Right, but for your toothpaste or beer can examples, those things get consumed, and then if anyone wants to consume the next year, it needs to get made again, whereas with gold, there's a very significant stock of it available above ground that could hit the market and, continue to provide supply outside of, what would be mined out of the ground.
Yeah, no, that is an important point. It is simultaneously the bearish argument on gold and the bullish argument on gold. To me, that's the argument about why gold is not a commodity. Gold is money. So if you compare gold to, like you said, beer or wheat or food or anything else, then yes, it's not consumed like everything else is. Everything else needs to be repeatedly produced. And so that makes demand more sustainable over time. So with gold, it's more of a supply story. Now, gold's not consumed, so people are right. It yields nothing. You don't eat it. It's not used industrially. It has really no use other than as money. That sounds a whole lot like dollar bills and euros and yen and all that. So, yes, all the gold produced is still there. Yes, all the dollars produced are still there. All the euros produced are all still there. They're not eating. They're growing. And so, this analogy of all this gold sitting there, it's true, but you shouldn't really compare gold to wheat. You should compare gold to dollars. And so... then it's not a demand story, it's a supply story. The supply of gold grows 1% a year, plus or minus. The supply of currencies has been growing double digit. Like I mentioned earlier, if you view all the gold in the U.S., and the world is getting a little bigger, but yeah, all the gold the U.S. had in 1975 or whatever, 1980, they probably still have it. Let's assume they still have it. They have not bought anymore. So, yes, you've got this pile of gold that's done nothing and it's produced nothing. And you've got this pile of dollars that has gone from 400 for each ounce of gold to 15,000 for each ounce of gold. So if rather than look at gold as a consumption commodity, we view it as a store of value. It's kept its value for 6,000 years. The currencies have never kept their value. The U.S. dollar, since we went off the gold standard, has lost 90-some-odd percent of its value. You print them, they lose their value. So, no, it is from a sustainable demand thing, a bad thing that gold's not consumed. For money, it's a wonderful thing. Money, you want it to be something that's not influenced by cyclicality of demand. You want money to be something that's not consumed, not used industrially, something that is divisible and non-corrosible and can not be printed by anybody and cannot be anybody else's liability. Gold is perfect for money, or damn near, and it's certainly over thousands of years been a much better form of money than fiat currencies always have and arguably always will be.
Okay, thank you very much.
And next we'll go to Stefan Roth with J.P. Morgan.
Yes, thank you. On the gold situation, how much of the gold price do you think is affected by the West versus the East? Because, you know, I'm always reading the papers about, you know, China coming up with a gold exchange and they in India rotating between one and two number consumer. But it seems like the price is controlled more in the Western markets that we see here. So I was just curious if you had thoughts on that.
Yeah, well, we could talk all day and get all kinds of views, and don't worry, I won't. But I think it's an interesting topic. I read all these articles lately about the pricing at the price sticks in London, and now that China's in on that, does that mean anything? And doesn't it give the people the ability to manipulate the price of gold even though they don't sell it? I don't know that it does. I don't quite follow that argument. I think what is happening, and like I say, people have to look long term as opposed to any month or year. What is happening is the wealth, gold representing the wealth, is going where it ought to go. If you look at China and Russia and India and places like that that create stuff and sell stuff and generally run trade surpluses. They sell stuff to the world that the world wants, and they deserve to get paid for that, and they are. And so where's the gold going? The gold is going to those countries. You see nonstop there is gold being bought by the central banks and the emerging markets. So gold's going where it ought to go. Where it's coming from is a matter of conjecture. Is it all coming from the West liquidating it, or is it coming from a lot of financial institutions selling futures on gold they don't even own? I don't know. But certainly the gold is migrating from West to East, and I believe it's migrating at a price that's way below any economic price. So this is working out, I think, very well for China and India and Russia, and then it's going to work up poorly for people in the West that are selling gold, I think. But as to whether the West has undue control of it, maybe, but I don't know why they want to keep the price. I know theories, but I don't know why they want to keep the price too low. They won't stay this way forever.
All right, thanks. Appreciate the feedback.
And next we'll go to Joseph Choi with PSQ Capital.
Hi, thank you for the presentation. And I just want to hear about your view on Bitcoin. It looks like recently the value of Bitcoin went up with the grid situation while the price of gold went down. And I'm just curious to know if you think Bitcoin has any chance of competing against gold in the form of currency.
Yeah. I think over the next 50 years, gold is fairly well assured to hold its value, and the U.S. dollar is fairly well assured to lose most of its value. What did Jim Grant say? That over a normal lifetime, if the Fed achieves its goal of devaluing 2% a year, that prices will go up 5 times in a normal lifetime. 80% of the value gone. So gold, good. The dollar, you better get paid a lot to hold it because it's going to lose most of its value. Bitcoin is a fascinating thing. I'm not going to pretend to be an expert. I find it kind of intriguing. I think that it's bringing in the scarcity value. So if they say we're going to fix the supply, and the Fed and the European Bank and the Japanese and everybody else say we are not going to fix the supply, we're going to print. Bitcoin seems kind of intriguing, doesn't it? It should gain value. So I like that part of it. The model all seems pretty good. The idea of allowing people to transact without being affected by government motives and things. I like all that a lot. So I mostly like it. However, the dollar and the euro and the yen and everything would actually be wonderful money too if governments could be trusted. No, we all know they can't. Can the computers and everybody else that are behind Bitcoin be trusted? I presume so, but I don't know so. I'm highly confident nobody's going to print a bunch of gold. Whether Bitcoins get materialized or somewhere, I don't know. So I guess I'm intrigued by Bitcoin, but I'll stick with gold.
Thank you.
And that does conclude our question and answer session. At this time, I'll turn it back to Mr. Ivan for any additional or closing comments.
All right. Well, no, thanks to all of you for listening in, for the good questions. And these are fascinating times. And it's been tough the last few months, but we love the situation it leads us in right now. And I don't know if I did point out, but our portfolio of what we think are wide moat companies are trading at less than 2/3 of book value right now. It's trading at huge discounts on to the index on price to book, price to earnings, price to cash flow, price to sales, and these are companies that control scarce goods and scarce franchises. So we're optimistic, but time will tell, and thanks once again to everybody.
And once again, that does conclude today's conference. We'd like to thank everyone for their participation.